Shalom from the Rabbi's Son, and welcome to our introduction to our fifth parsha of Torah, Hayesera. Our studies for Hayesera begin in Genesis 23:1 through 25:18. The half Torah readings come from 1 Kings 1:1 through 31, and the Brit Hadashah readings come from 1 Corinthians 15, verses 35 through 58. Welcome to Hayesera. I call this three-chapter section of Torah the Parsha of the Changing of the Guard, because it marks the passing of one matriarch and patriarch team and goes to great lengths to introduce us to another. The first one to leave us is Sarah. In the second verse of the Parsha, we're told Sarah died at Kiryat Arba. After a new matriarch of the covenant household's established, the changing of the guard theme will affect the patriarchal side of the family as well. For Torah will tell us, and then Avraham breathed his last and died in a good old age, an old man and full of years, and was gathered to his people. Oh, the times, they are changing. And as we enter to the week of the changing of the guard, all of physical creation is testifying beautifully of the same theme. In the northern hemisphere of planet Earth, the leaves of the trees are in various stages of changing color and falling to the ground. In the southern hemisphere, the trees are bursting into bloom and breaking forth in life. The constant in the physical realm of Earth is the tree. Season after season, the tree stands. In the spiritual realm, the constant is the covenant. Generation after generation, millennia after millennia, it stands. The life source, it remains and abides and brings forth new life and new fruit in season. And as for you, may the testimony of your life from this point forward be that you will be like a tree planted by the rivers of living water, which brings forth fruit in its season. In the course of our readings, this week we will say a gracious goodbye to the first of our beloved matriarchs, Sarah, and say a hearty hello to our second beloved matriarch, Rivka, Rebecca. So what, you say? Beloved, these are not just women in the Bible. They're your family. These are the trees from the holy seed that dwells in your body, soul, and spirit, from which they emanated. Whether through natural ancestry or engrafting in Messiah, they're a part of your bloodline. Who they were is a significant part of who you are. Now, this week is probably a good time to stop and consider the significance of the impact not only they, but also other women of faith in your ancestry have had on your life. It's a week when it's especially appropriate to give thanks for the positive influences of the godly women you've been privileged to know. So I invite you to join with me as we have a little family celebration of the tremendous nurturing power of a woman's love. A part of you, I warn you, is going to die this week. But do not fear, for a part of you is also going to be sought out and tested and ransomed from darkness this week. And after having been brought and bought with a great price, that part of you will find yourself in your bridegroom's embrace, and experience the light of his countenance, and taste the pleasures and depths of his love. The Parsha of Changing the Guard begins by abruptly informing us that Sarah has died, and for 127 years she walked this planet, and then she was gone. It's interesting that the divine author gives us no warning whatever that our beloved matriarchs, even under the weather, neither in this Parsha nor anywhere else will Torah inform us of the cause or specific circumstances of her death. We're simply told she's gone. May we hear her laughter again soon. After receiving the stunning news of Sarah's passing, we're given a detailed account of Avraham's negotiations for and purchase of a burial plot for her. Avraham will purchase this place called Machpelah from the sons of Het for the extravagant price of 400 shekels of silver. This parcel of real estate will become the first tract of land in Eretz Canaan to come under Hebrew dominion. After Sarah has laid to rest in the cave of Machpelah, Avraham will set about the process of acquiring a bride for Yitzhak. We will travel with Eliezer to the Well of Matriarchs in Haran. We will hear his prayer, and then we will be told, before he'd finished speaking, that behold, Rebekah, who was born to Betuel, son of Milcah, the wife of Nahor, Avraham's brother, came out with her pitcher on her shoulder. We will marvel at the process and circumstances of the selection of Rivkah bat Betuel as Yitzhak's bride. And after a marriage covenant secured for Yitzhak, we will see the focus of the Torah narrative turn back to Avraham. Our beloved patriarch Avraham will remarry, we will discover, and will become the father of 6 more nations. Avraham again took a wife, and her name was Keturah, and she bore him Zimran, Yokshan, Medan, Midian, Yishbach, and Shauah. We will then see Avraham pass away at the ripe age of 175 years. We'll even see Yitzhak and Yishmael working side by side for the first time as they lay Avraham to rest alongside Yitzhak's mother, Sarah. Parshas Sarah will then conclude with a description of Avraham's genealogy, which will prepare us for the transition to the next Parsha we will study, called Todot. This week's Parsha tells us about the life of Sarah. The manner in which Torah is going to cover this fascinating subject will prove very interesting. Torah is not going to tell us about the life of Sarah in a way that it's told us about the life of Avraham. About what then will we read in this Parsha that will teach us about the life of Sarah? We will read in the text of this Parsha about only 2 things pertaining to the life of Sarah: her funeral and the legacy she left behind, and how that legacy was picked up by her niece Rivkah and carried forth into the next generation. As discussed, the departure point for our meditations this week is the news that our beloved matriarch Sarah has passed from this world to the next. But Sarah's story does not by any means mean that it ends with her death. To the contrary, in Sarah's case, the instant of breathing of last breath is instead where her story truly begins. Never underestimate the value of a matriarch. Matriarchs are the glue that hold a household of faith together. How well a culture recognizes and honors and walks in the wisdom of its current generation of matriarchs, on the one hand, and how well it chooses and nurtures and trains up its next generation, on the other hand, are perhaps the 2 most critical sociological factors that will determine how strong the culture will become and what kind of impact it will have on the world. Sarah has rightly come to be regarded as the mother of all Israel. As Avraham is recognized as the father of all who believe, Sarah is rightly considered the mother of all who follow God. She is a beloved kinswoman of Jew and Gentile alike. Now, before getting into the text of this week's Parsha, therefore, let us prepare our hearts for a few moments by focusing upon what we already know from previous Parshot about the life of Sarah. As we all know by now, when we were introduced to Avraham's wife by the Torah, her name was not Sarah, usually translated as ruler or governor, but Sarai, meaning my princess. The verb root of both of the names by which our beloved matriarch is known is Sarar, meaning to rule or govern. The Hebraic word pictograph hieroglyphic formed by the letters is that of the most common physical manifestation of the presence, empowering one king who then empowers another person to act on his behalf. To make the name Sarai, one must drop the last resh, replacing it with a yod, is a hieroglyphic of a king extending his hand. This illustrates the reality that Sarai was the Holy One's hands extended. To make the name Sarah, both the resh at the end of the verb root Sarar and the yod at the end of the name Sarai are dropped and are replaced with a hey. The word formed is a picture of the Holy One's king revealed and made visible. Sarai was merely a vessel used by the Holy One in one generation. Sarah was the mother of Yitzhak, the child of promise, who transcends generation. And the birth and life of Yitzhak is the picture of the government of the Holy One. The message is this. The woman who would become our matriarch started out as merely a princess. However, by the king's prophetic empowerment, she became the queen mother and ruled the household of the covenant people by power delegated to her by Avraham. Our first introduction to the woman we now know so affectionately as our matriarch came at the end of Parsha Noach. At that time, she had just been taken as a wife by a descendant of Shem who was then known as Avram. We're not told anything whatever about her lineage. We don't know who her father was, her mother was, or if she had siblings. All we're told about her in that brief introduction was that Sarai was barren and had no child. Sarai bore that label, and the wounded identity that went with it, many years. But she did not, by any means, carry it to her grave. She was set gloriously free from it. The Sarah we all know now, and remember fondly, was not merely the wife of Avraham, and was by no means barren. The Sarah we know, and whose blessed memory we cherish, was the mother of Yitzhak, the prototypical miraculous child of promise. Part of the legacy we receive from Sarah is that this beloved matriarch believed and followed in her dreamer husband where few women would go. In response to a divine call that she did not even personally hear, she nonetheless left the only home she had ever known, as well as all her family members, and struck out on an odyssey fraught with both hardship and peril. Sarah was extremely beautiful, with a kind of beauty that didn't diminish even in the latter stages of her life. She was so beautiful that wherever she went, rich and powerful kings, men accustomed to getting what they wanted, well, they desired her. This put Avram's life in danger. To protect Avram from being killed, therefore, Sarai agreed when entering a dangerous new domain to tell people she was Avram's sister. It was her way of protecting Avram. But it definitely didn't protect Sarah. Twice in her life, she found herself being taken into the harem of a foreign king. And Sarah's harem adventures turned out to be the first real evidence she received of the Holy One's goodness and blessing. Though taken into two powerful kings' harems, she was in both cases miraculously protected, losing neither her life nor her marriage nor virtue nor place in the divine plan for the redemption of mankind. As aforesaid, Sarah was barren during all the years of her life when most women expect to bear and raise children. The emotional fallout from this barrenness led her, at one point, to make the one decision in her life that she would most have to live with regret. Desperate to give her beloved husband the son and heir he so badly wanted, she entrusted Avram into the tent and arms of Hagar. It became an ill-conceived and ill-fated plan precisely because it worked so well. Hagar became pregnant with Avram's child, and that changed everything. Strife entered Sarah's relationship with Avram, and mutual jealousy destroyed Sarah's second closest relationship, that with Hagar. Last week, after all these things, Sarah finally had her first recorded God encounter, in the course of which the Holy One caused she, who had known little in life but sorrow, to laugh. Then finally, by divine empowerment, she was able to conceive and give birth and nurse at her own breast the child through whose bloodline all the Holy One's promises were to be fulfilled. Sarai quickly realized that it was absolutely necessary, in order for the plan of the Holy One with regard to Yitzhak to come to fruition, for her to make tikkun for the biggest mistake of her life. She therefore successfully lobbied, first with the Holy One, then with Avraham, to have her stepchild, Yishmael, along with her former closest confidant, Hagar, to be karat from the covenant community. She thereby assured that Yitzhak would not suffer either the abuse or the evil influence of the people who despised him most. In another context, the Holy One was able to say of Job, "Have you considered my servant Job? There is no one on earth like him. He is blameless and upright, a man who fears God and shuns evil." It appears something similar could be said of Sarai. She is an Eshet Hayil, a woman of virtue. Hebrew Midrash tells us that Sarai's life was supernatural. The ancient legend says that the candles she lit on Shabbat each stayed lit for 7 days until it was time to kindle them again. The legend teaches us also that the challah bread she baked every Friday for Erev Shabbat stayed fresh all week until she replaced it the next Erev Shabbat. And finally, the Midrash tells us that throughout her marriage to Avraham, a pillar of fire rested over Sarah's tent. One cannot review these legends without realizing that the ancients were connecting Sarah's tent with the Mishkan, its menorah, its table of showbread, and the radiant cloud of his presence that rested above the mercy seat of the Holy Ark. What was the point? The point is that we're all to consider our purpose in life to be that which the ancients ascribed to Sarah, to make earthly homes for the manifest radiant presence of the Holy One. All our houses should reflect the holiness of the temple. The face of every one of us should radiate the divine light of the Holy One. The mouth of every one of us should pour forth fresh portions of the bread of life from the word of the Holy One, every day empowering all who know us. Our hearts should be the resting place for the Holy One's radiance in the spheres of influences that we have. Our hands should be constantly yielded as instruments of the Master, used by Him in His timing to fulfill His purposes on earth and make tikkun for the evil that has been released in the world by those who live according to the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Such was the life of Sarah. She wasn't perfect. She was by no means sinless. She laughed, it seemed, at all the wrong times. But even in the midst of her failings, she was ever shedding light, ever laying forth the breath of life, and ever making her heart and home a habitation for the Holy One. As stated before, Sarah is described in Torah as being very beautiful. And let's consider the nature and essence of her beauty. In Genesis 12:11, Avram was en route to Egypt to ride out the famine, and he found when he got to Eretz Canaan. And Torah records him saying to Sarah, "I realize you're a woman of beautiful appearance." Ordinarily, beauty is considered an asset. Avram, however, realized that in the world in which he lived were rich and powerful people, into whose domain he was about to enter, took by force any woman they considered beautiful. Being married to a beautiful woman could be hazardous. Avram's manner of dealing with Sarah's beauty was to have her pretend that she was his sister. But what kind of beauty was it Sarah possessed? By the time she and Avram went to Egypt, she was already 65 years of age. While people lived longer in those days, and thus Sarah was by no means ancient or invalid when she and Avram went to Egypt, at 65 she was certainly no spring chicken either. Moreover, the custom of the era and the necessity of desert life was for a woman to, at least in the presence of males, cover most of her face with a veil and to dress very modestly, in layers of loose, flowing robes which concealed all their womanly attributes and endowments from the view. Please understand that both the desert and the dress of the ancient desert were great equalizers. If you were to take the most sought-after cover girl model, or starlet today, and dress her in ancient desert dress and cover her face with a veil, and ride her around on a donkey or camel in the windstorms and heat of the desert for a few months, and then put her fully covered in a lineup with the homeliest daughters of the desert, do you really believe you could tell just by looking which one the model was, cover girl or the starlet was? Not likely. So what was it about Sarai that would cause Avraham to fear that a man like Pharaoh would want her? The beauty of which Avraham spoke in Genesis 12:11 had to be much more than just the superficial stuff of cover girls and fashion models. It had to deal with something way, way beyond a pretty face or well-shaped body. To understand Sarah, perhaps we need to look at beauty from a Hebraic rather than Greco-Western mindset. The Hebrew word translated as beautiful in Genesis 12:11 is yafat. This word is translated into English as to be beautiful. It's actually a Hebraic pictograph of the hand and mouth serving as a source of revelation and inspiration. While Sarai at 65 may or may not have been a 21st century knockout under all those flowing robes and veils, she was definitely beautiful in deed and in word. And not only were what she did and what she said beautiful, those words and actions were also inspiring and full of revelation. And of course, the fact that the hey at the end of the word was replaced by a tav, meaning in a pictographic sense, the revelation, inspiration which Sarai's deeds and words directed people was to the fulfillment of the covenant. What made Sarah beautiful thus was that both her deeds and her words made the richness and blessing of the covenant of the Holy One come to life wherever she went. Sarah was not just beautiful, she was blessed. Hebraically, to bless means to release the object of blessing from restrictions. Note the two separate blessings the Holy One pronounced over Sarah. The first blessing was that Abraham would have a son through her. This blessing released her, not only from the restriction of a barren womb, but also the restrictions of her and her husband's age and infertility. This first blessing came to fruition in her lifetime in the birth of Yitzhak. The second blessing the Holy One spoke over Sarah was that she would become nations and kings of people that shall come to her. The second part of the blessing involved multiple generations to come, and thus this part of the blessing could only become fruition after her death. This second part of the blessing released Sarah from the restriction of mortality. Sarah did not just live on in Yitzhak, she lives on today through the nation she mothered, Am Yisrael. What then is Sarah's life? It's the life of the Hebrew people. And so it goes on even today. If you want to understand the Hebrew people and their purpose, the reason that they're there for, just study Sarah's life. In both this week's Torah and Haftarah portions, a generation of the Holy One's people will approach and in some cases enter into death. However, in both cases, a new generation will be called upon and commissioned to take up the torch of the Holy One. In the case of Abraham, the text of Torah will tell us that not only did he die, but that afterwards he was gathered to his people. Now, the promise of eternal life is the heart cry of modern evangelical Christendom. If you die tonight, do you know where you would spend eternity? Is the question asked from pulpit after pulpit and on street corners. But it's important to understand that eternal life's not a doctrine that suddenly sprung into existence with the appearance of Yeshua. From the discussion in Genesis 5 of Enoch's failure to see death, to the common statement concerning the patriarchs that they were gathered to their people, to the passionate expressions of the psalmist, the Tanakh is chock full of the promise of eternal life. Eternal life is in Hebrew thought not as subjected for theological debate, but assumed as a reality, an essential part of our framework of givens. But as real and assumed as it is, eternal life is not the focus of the Bible, nor should it be our focus. The focus is upon life on earth, not life in heaven or hell. Here and now, we're connected with the Holy One. We're to identify ourselves with His will and His ways, and thereby start fulfilling our purpose. Here and now, and in the few short years between our natural birth and our natural death.